The title of today's sermon is The Sabbath Through the Centuries. The Sabbath Through the Centuries. In a previous sermon called Sabbath to Sunday, we studied how the church substituted the seventh day Saturday Sabbath to Sunday. Some chose Sunday to avoid persecution that the Jews were receiving. The Roman authorities couldn't tell the difference between a Sabbath-keeping Christian group and a Jewish group, so they just persecuted them all. So some people wanted to switch to Sunday to avoid that problem. Some Christian groups were actually anti-Semitic, another reason they chose that. And also it was convenient for people who are already worshiping the sun on Sunday to start worshiping in Christianity on Sunday. Those are the reasons, the basic reasons they chose Sunday worship. Discussions on that subject went on for hundreds of years, and then finally in 325, the Council of Nicaea formalized the change from Sabbath to Sunday in most Christian churches, but not all. First, it'd be good to talk about the New Testament proof of the Sabbath day, just a few verses on that, just to remind us, because the churches who made that decision did not have the authority to change the day of worship. First, Luke chapter 4, verse 15, talking about Jesus Christ. Luke 4:15, and he taught in their synagogues, being glorified by all. So he came to Nazareth, where he had been brought up. And as his custom was, he went into the synagogue on the Sabbath day and stood up to read. Shows Jesus Christ clearly keeping the Sabbath as an example. Next, chapter 13, starting in verse 42. This is where Paul was visiting Antioch, and he found some Jews there and spoke to them. Acts 13, verse 42. So when the Jews went out of the synagogue, the Gentiles begged that these words might be preached to them the next Sabbath. Now when the congregation had broken up, many of the Jews and devout proselytes followed Paul and Barnabas, who, speaking to them, persuaded them to continue in the grace of God. On the next Sabbath, almost the whole city came together to hear the word of God. Here we had Paul speaking to Gentiles and Jews on the Sabbath, as an example. In Hebrews chapter 4, verse 9, we have an interesting statement here. It says, there remains, therefore, a rest for the people of God. And that word rest is unusual in the New Testament for where it comes from in the Greek, number 4520, sabbatism. I've heard it pronounced sabbatismos. The idea is it's a Sabbath rest. It's not just a regular rest. So there remains a Sabbath rest for the people of God. Just a few verses to show us that, yes, we should be keeping the Sabbath. Well, how important is it? Exodus chapter 31. If you start in verse 16, we're going to start there first. Exodus 31:16. Therefore, the children of Israel shall keep the Sabbath, to observe the Sabbath throughout their generations as a perpetual covenant. It is a sign between me and the children of Israel forever. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, and on the seventh day he rested and was refreshed. The Sabbath is a sign to identify the creator of the heavens and the earth, the creator of the universe. The Sabbath identifies him as that. And go back to verse 13, another sign. Speak also to the children of Israel, saying, surely my Sabbath you shall keep, for it is a sign between me and you throughout your generations, that you may know that I am the Lord who sanctifies you, sanctifies us, makes us holy. The Sabbath is a sign of who God makes holy, who God sanctifies, who God's people are. It's very important. It's a very important sign to show who God's people are, and we must keep that sign. Today we're going to talk about the evidence that the seventh-day Sabbath has been kept throughout church history. This is not a new concept for Christians to keep the Sabbath, not something that was just developed in the last 50, 100, 200 years. It goes on much, much beyond that. First of all, let's look at the Sabbath keepers in the 5th century. We have this quote. Down even to the 5th century, the observance of the Jewish Sabbath was continued in the Christian church, but with a rigor and solemnity gradually diminishing. This is from Coleman's Ancient Christianity Exemplified, quoted in Duggar and Dodd's History of the True Religion. It's one of my sources that I've used, is Duggar and Dodd's History of the True Religion. This is showing us, just giving an idea that the Sabbath was being kept even after, in the 4th century, the Roman Church decided not to keep the Sabbath. In the 5th century, people were still keeping the Sabbath. They call it the Jewish Sabbath. It's hard to find records of people keeping the Sabbath throughout the centuries. These people were very badly persecuted, many tortured, many martyred, houses and churches burned. So records are not that common. And some of the records are even from the people who persecuted them. But yet there are enough records that we can see that part of the church was keeping the Sabbath. And then the Pauliani, which we know better as the Paulicians, who were the same people at an earlier date, were Quarto de Simeons and kept Easter in the primitive manner at the Jewish date. Okay, these Paulani or Paulicians had been condemned as heretics in the 5th century. The Quarto de Simeons, those are people who keep the Passover on the 14th quarto, the Quarto D-E-C, that means 14 basically, people who kept the Passover on the 14th as opposed to Easter Sunday. And they use the word Easter here. Passover and Easter are similar in some languages, or the other thing to consider too is that some of the people writing may not fully know the difference. But the point was that these people, these Paulicians, were keeping the Passover. I'll continue reading. John of Autzen's language perhaps implies that the old believers in Armenia during the 7th century were Quarto de Simeons, as we should expect them to be, people who kept the Passover on the 14th day of the first month. The Sabbath was perhaps kept, and there were no special Sunday observances. People observed the Sabbath in the 5th and 7th centuries. This is from Dr. Fred Koenigbaer's translation of The Key of Truth. That's a book that was written about 800 in Eastern Europe, and of the history of the church to some extent. And it included some comments of what was going on in previous centuries. This is quoted in John of Gwynn's God's Church Through the Ages. It's a booklet put out by a group that no longer exists. I use them for a number of other things in today's sermon. The Paulicians had a lot of God's truth, but unfortunately they gave in to persecution, like having their babies baptized and attending Catholic Sunday services to avoid persecution. They adopted a lot of those customs, eventually were assimilated by the Catholic Church to a large extent, but not entirely. Let's go on. It's the 6th through 11th centuries. We have what's called the Vaudois, which are the valley dwellers. That's the translation of that in French. The people who lived in cities in the Roman Empire, and they had to flee to northern Italy and southern France to avoid persecution. So sometimes people were tortured, killed, had their houses burned. Sometimes they were able to flee. And these people were able to flee. And they fled to alpine valleys, which were not well populated, somewhat isolated. They observed the seventh-day Sabbath. They baptized their people by immersion instead of babies by pouring or sprinkling. They kept the Passover once a year in the first month, in other words, at the right time. And they were later called Waldensians. We'll talk about them a little bit later. 692 AD, Pope Justinian II called the Sixth General Council, and it condemned Saturdays. This is important to know, because for him to have a council that condemned Saturdays, that means some people were still worshiping on Saturdays in 692. And then, the 8th century, the Paulicians were forcibly resettled in the Balkans. The idea was that they'd be kind of a buffer between European countries and the Muslims. And those Balkan countries might have included like Greece, Bulgaria, Romania, Serbia, and Croatia. And they were called Bogomils. A number of them were assimilated by Islam. As the Islamic armies came in, forced them to convert, or some were killed, some others were assimilated. Others of the Paulicians spread back to Piedmont, in Lombard Italy and southern France. In 1104, Peter de Bries began to preach among the Bogomils who went to the Piedmont, and he was preaching repentance among them. Many of them had given up some of their beliefs, and he got things straightened out again for them. Now the Waldensians, it's in the 12th century. In 1161, Peter Waldo began to preach. A good friend of his had suddenly died, and it shocked Peter Waldo. He got hold of a Bible somehow. It would have been a Latin Bible at that time. And began to study it. Then he began to preach. He kept the Sabbath. He found that in the Bible. He kept the Passover only once a year. He was in Lyon, France, but eventually had to move to the mountain valleys of the Alps in northern Italy. Here's another quote. Investigators made a report to Louis XII. He reigned 1498 to 1516. This is to get a little bit of history. He was the king of France, that they had visited all the parishes where the Waldenses dwelt. They had inspected all their places of worship, but they found no images, no sign of the ordinances belonging to the Mass, nor of any of the sacraments of the Roman Church. By the way, this was all considered very bad, that they didn't find any of these things in the Waldensian churches. They expected to see what you'd find in a Catholic church. They kept the Sabbath day. They observed the ordinance of baptism according to the primitive church. That would mean not pouring on babies. They despised the feast of Easter and all other Roman festival of Christ and the saints. This is from William Jones' Handbook of Church History. It shows that they were not keeping the same holy days that the church at large was keeping. Waldensians lived in northwestern Italy. If you were to look at a map, you'd see it's in the northwest corner of Italy, area called the Piedmont or Piemonte in Italy. In the center of it is a city called Torino, also known as Turin. You might know it by that. But that is the general area where they were living, where the Waldensians were living in the 12th and 13th centuries. Another quote. Their enemies confirmed their great antiquity. Rainerius Sacco, an inquisitor and one of their most implacable enemies, who lived only 80 years after Waldo. Let's stop a minute here. Talk about an inquisitor. There was an inquisition in the 1200s where the Roman Church was seeking out those heretics and getting them to either recant under torture or they would kill them, and it was a horrible time for people who did not agree with the Roman Church. Well, here's one of their inquisitors. He admits that the Waldenses flourished 500 years before that preacher, Waldo, which would take you back to 600 AD. Gretzker, the Jesuit, who also wrote against the Waldenses and had examined the subject fully, not only admits their great antiquity, but he declares his firm belief that the Toulousians and Albigensians were none other than Waldenses. In fact, their doctrine, discipline, government, manners, and even the errors with which they've been charged by the Catholics show that the Albigenses and Waldenses were distinct branches of the same sect, or that the former sprang from the later. Dr. Rankin's History of France in Jones' Church History. Yes, we find that the Waldensians didn't really start with Peter Waldo, as some of their enemies claimed. It's easier to say that something like that, especially in that period of time, that's just a new idea that this Peter Waldo has, and they could try to fight it that way. But no, it had gone for 500 years before that, all the way back to the Valdois. In fact, people didn't like to call the Valdois the Valdois. They liked to call them Waldensians. It sounds somewhat similar. And if you call them Waldensians, then it's naming after a man who started preaching in 1161. But instead, it actually goes back a lot further. Another quote from a book called Waldensians Researches by Gilly. The method which Alex has pursued in his history of the churches of Piedmont is to show that in the ecclesiastical history of every century from the 4th, which he considers a period early enough for the inquirer after apostolic purity of doctrine, what he's saying from the 4th century when he thinks that the doctrines were pure, there are clear proofs that doctrines unlike those that the Roman Church holds and conformable to the belief of the Waldensian and Reformed churches, were maintained by theologians of the north of Italy down the period when the Waldenses first came into notice. Consequently, the opinions of the Waldenses were not new to Europe in the 11th or 12th centuries, and there's nothing improbable in the tradition that the subalpine church persevered in its integrity in an interrupted course from the first preaching of the gospel in the valleys. More evidence that Waldenses' doctrine of this, like the Sabbath, Passover, that sort of thing, had been going on for hundreds and hundreds of years at this point. One of the things they did was to translate the Bible. Waldo arranged that. Waldenses were among the first of the people of Europe to obtain before the Reformation the possession of the Bible in manuscript of their native tongue. They had the truth unadulterated, and this rendered them special objects of hatred and persecutions. Here for 1,000 years, witnesses for the truth maintained the ancient faith in a most wonderful manner, yet the word of truth was preserved through all ages of darkness. That's our authorized Bible, vindicated by Wilkinson. Just more proof that they had been preaching the truth in the Alpine valleys for 1,000 years, from around 400, 500 up to 1400 AD. 1170 AD, there was some persecution. Information of these things, the ministry of Waldo, was then conveyed to Pope Alexander III, who no sooner heard of such heretical proceedings than he anathemized the reformer and his adherents, commanding the archbishop to proceed against them with the utmost rigor. That doesn't mean just that the archbishop yelled at him. No, he had control of the local army where he could have them tortured and killed. Waldo was now compelled to quit Lyon, that's in eastern France. His flock in a great measure followed their pastor, and hence a dispersion took place, not unlike which arose in the Church of Jerusalem on the occasion of the death of Stephen. The effect is also similar. His, Waldo's principles took deep and lasting root and produced numerous harvest of disciples who were denominated Lyonists, Vaudois, Albigenses, or Waldenses, for the very same class of Christians is designated by these various appellations at different countries or quarters of the same country in which they appear. Jones Church History, 1837. Yes, Waldo had to leave Lyon. If you look at the map, you can see Lyon is pretty close to the Piedmont area where I mentioned that the Waldenses actually ended up. He fled to the mountains, basically. It mentions some other groups, and like Albigenses, it's not clear what their doctrines were. One of the references I had seemed to think they were Sabbath keepers. Other references say they weren't and had some off-the-wall ideas. Don't really know. Waldenses had the truth for a long time, eventually gave up a lot, but not up to this point. The general body of the Albigenses received the doctrines of Peter Waldo, and that the Waldenses and Albigenses were two branches of the same sect. They may have had the same beliefs at one point. The Albigenses certainly changed. The Latin Vulgate Bible was the only edition of the sacred book at that time in Europe. Remember, Gutenberg's Bible, 1453, was Latin. Not too many people could read it. It was nice, it was printed. You could start getting into some mass production, if you want to call it that, although it wasn't really a big production run. Still, it was Latin. Most people couldn't read it. The Latin Vulgate Bible was the only edition of the sacred book at that time in Europe. And the languages then in common use, the French and others, however mixed with Latin, were properly speaking by this time separate and distinct from it. In other words, French and others are called a Romance language based on Latin, but people who spoke French at the time could not read or understand spoken Latin. It really was a foreign language and a dead language. It appears that the Christian world under Providence was indebted to Waldo for the first translation of the Bible into a modern tongue. This is Townsend's original. Waldo was the first one. He didn't translate it himself. He hired it out. He didn't feel like he could do it, apparently. But he was able to get it done, and it was the first one. And it was in French. And in 1179, Peter Waldo died in Bohemia. He'd had to flee again, not just in the Piedmont area. He eventually had to flee over into Germany and then Bohemia, fleeing persecution. At this time, there were Waldensians throughout Europe. And like I say, he died in 1179, but his work continued. He's well respected. There's a statue of Peter Waldo at the Luther Memorial in Worms, Germany, along with others. He preceded the Reformation by a long time and went a lot farther than they did in terms of correcting the doctrines of the church. Now, continuing the Waldensians in the 13th through 15th centuries. 13th century, Waldensians were in 22 countries of Europe, including Britain. Well, they were persecuted. 1224, Emperor Frederick II of Rome wrote this: "We condemn to perpetual infamy and withdraw our protection from and put under our ban the Puritans, Paterines, Leonists, Arnoldists, Josephines, Albigenses, Waldenses, etc., and all other heretics of both sexes and of whatever name." It's from Jones Church History. The Emperor of Rome, he withdrew protection. And you can just imagine what that meant. That opened the door for persecution of these groups, including the Waldenses. The Council of Toulouse established the Inquisition to complete the work of heresy. And in 1229, first forbade the use of the scriptures in the vulgar tongue. That's from Orchard's History of the Baptist Church. 1229, first talking about the Inquisition, as I mentioned, where they used to round up the heretics and get them to recant. And if they didn't, they died. Some recanted. There's records of that. Others chose to die for their faith. And in 1229, forbade the use of the scriptures in the vulgar tongue. What that means is, you could not translate the Bible into a modern language. It's vulgar not meaning obscene, it means vulgar as in of the people. And this was quite a ways after Waldo had translated the Bible into French. They finally came up with this official statement that they were not to be doing that. It had been forbidden before, just maybe wasn't documented well. By 1315, there were 80,000 Waldensians in Bohemia. Remember, I told you Waldo had fled to Bohemia. Going on a little bit further there, in 1487, Pope Innocent VIII ordered the Vaudois in Piedmont to be killed. And he sent troops there, and they were unsuccessful. At that point, the Vaudois were actually taking up arms, which, of course, is not allowed. But they had different beliefs at that time, and they did that, and miraculously, though, were not taken over by the forces of the Pope. On to the 16th century. The Reformers, Luther, Calvin, Knox, and others, with all their zeal and learning, were babes in spiritual knowledge when compared with the Waldenses, particularly in regard to the nature of the kingdom of Christ and its institutions, laws, and worship in general. In AD 1530, one of the pastors of the Waldenses, George Morell, published the memoir of his church. He said there were then 800,000 Jones Church History. Now you think about it, the Reformers, they missed a lot. Sure, they took care of a lot of the abuses of the Roman Church, but they missed certain things like the Sabbath and the holy days and baptism of adults and things like that. So the Waldensians had figured all that out, so that's why this author says that those other people were like babes in spiritual knowledge compared to the Waldenses. More about them in the 16th century. There's records at 1552, the Waldensians still kept the Sabbath. 1559, we have this quote. They implored His Highness. This is a letter from the Waldenses to their ruler to get some relief from the persecution they were experiencing. They implored His Highness to consider that their religious profession was not a thing of yesterday, as their adversaries falsely reported, but had been the profession of their fathers, grandfathers, and great-grandfathers, yea, their predecessors of still more ancient times, even with the martyrs, confessors, apostles, and prophets. and they called upon their adversaries to prove the contrary if they're able. Persuaded, therefore, as they were, that their religion was not a human invention, but founded upon the word of God, which shall remain forever, they were confident that no human force would be able to extinguish it. From Jones Church History. This was where they felt a need to explain that their religion was not something new, but had gone back to ancient times. And they were asking for protection, for relief, for the persecution they were receiving at that time. But, like so many of the groups before them, not everyone stayed with the truth. Late 16th century, many Waldensians were assimilated by the Lutherans, taking their doctrines, you know, back to Sunday, back to Easter, etc. But not all. Some Waldensians still remained faithful to the truth. In 1665, Oliver Cromwell wrote this in defense of the Waldensians in Savoy, Northern Italy. But if, on the other hand, he shall continue firmly resolved utterly to destroy and to drive to a state of distraction those men among whom our religion was either planted by the first preachers of the gospel and so maintained in its purity from age to age, or else reformed and restored to its primitive purity more early than among many other nations, we hereby declare ourselves ready to advise, in common with you and the rest of our brethren and allies of the Reformed religion, by what means we may most conveniently provide for the preservation and comfort of these distressed people. Oliver Cromwell in England, he was defending the Waldensians, and he's saying that either these people had the religion right from the very beginning, or they had reformed the errors of the Roman Church before anybody else did. Remember, 1665 is about 100 years after the Protestant Reformation started. So he was defending them and saying that their beliefs have been around for a long time. They deserve to be defended. Another group called the Lollards, a man by the name of Walter Lollard, began preaching the doctrines of the Waldensians in 1315. And then here's a quote that talks a little bit about them. They now abounded, more than half the nation became Lollards, and yes, they covered all England. Isn't that interesting? Someone that I'd never heard of before, but they covered much of England, they said. In 1389, they formed separate and distinct societies agreeable to Scripture. Their hostility to the hierarchy and their numbers aroused their enemies to adopt severe measures. In the year 1400, a law was passed sentencing Lollards to be burned to death. It's more of that persecution we talked about. In Norfolk, in England, they abounded, and there they suffered severely. Still, the Bible men increased and became dangerous to the church. They are said to have numbered 100,000. It's amazing how big the Church of God was at certain times in history. Henry VIII, while in conflict with the Pope, relieved and encouraged the Lollards in his kingdom, and this led to their persecuted brethren from all parts of Europe to flock to England in great numbers to enjoy religious liberty and to strengthen the cause of true religion. This is Benedict's history. A large number of these Lollards keeping the Sabbath and the Passover, and Henry VIII even supported them. He was in conflict with the Pope, and anybody the Pope considered to be an enemy was going to be a friend of Henry VIII. And he encouraged them. What this did, though, was when Sabbath-keeping people in other parts of Europe were being persecuted, they knew they could go to England where they would be protected, have freedom of religion in their way at least. And it lasted for a while. If we look at a map of England, even up into Scotland, we see areas where the Lollards lived, at least 100,000 of them at times, maybe more than that. And in the 14th century, they could have been using a Wycliffe Bible. That was the first well-known English translation of the Bible. And it's a type of early English that none of us could probably read easily, at least. And it's hard enough to read an original 1611 King James. But if you were to look at a 1400s Wycliffe Bible, it's even less familiar to us. But yet that's what they had to preach from, and there were enough people who could read English that it was well known. Keep talking about the Sabbath in England now, into the 16th and 17th centuries. there was a church called the Milliard Church in London, and their secretary wrote about another Sabbath-keeping church. I find that the Pinner's Hall Sabbatarian Church was established at Devonshire Square on March 1st, 1574. In 1830 came the Milliard Church to hold their services. So there was a Sabbath-keeping church in England in 1574. This Milliard Church, let's read about that, the origin. Some have supposed that this church owes its origin to the labors of John James, who was martyred October 9, 1661. President Dalen goes back as far as about 1580. They're telling us that this Milliard Church goes back to possibly 1580. In 1617 or 1616, John Trask came to London from Salisbury and held revival meetings. One of his disciples, named Hamlet Jackson, was the means of bringing Trask and many, if not all, of his congregation to the observance of the seventh-day Sabbath in about 1617. And Elder William Jones says that this Traskite congregation was the origin of the Milliard Church. It's from the History of the Seventh-day Baptists. This Milliard Church started keeping the Sabbath around 1617. It's not in its present location anymore. Now it's just a two-story building somewhere in London. But it is the oldest known Sabbath-keeping church still functioning. We don't know what their doctrines are like other than keeping the Sabbath. At least they're keeping the Sabbath after all these centuries. Talk about the Sabbath in the 17th century now. The records of 1642, 1649, 1703, Anabaptists keeping the seventh-day Sabbath and believing in the personal reign of Christ on earth during the millennium. Well, that's something I didn't come across very much of as to what people understood about the millennium over the centuries. Well, they believed in the personal reign of Christ in the millennium, just as we do. And they're called Anabaptists, so the people who are Anabaptists, baptized again. If they had Catholics who were baptized as babies and wanted to join them, they'd require them to be baptized as adults in the proper way. Some of these were called Anti-Baptists because they opposed Catholics' baptism. But they kept the Sabbath and understood the millennium. And then we have the church beginning to come into America. The church in England began to decline at some point. And in 1664, Stephen Mumford emigrated from England to Newport, Rhode Island. He brought with him the opinion that the Ten Commandments, as they were delivered from Mount Sinai, were moral and immutable, and that it was an anti-Christian power which changed the Sabbath from the seventh to the first day of the week. He united with the Baptist Church in Newport and soon gained several of its members to observe the Sabbath. It's from Lewis's History of Sabbath and Sunday. He went to Rhode Island, and Stephen Mumford and his wife. They went to Rhode Island because it was really the first colony that had true freedom of religion. Other people went to the colonies, like the Mayflower, Pilgrims and Puritans, etc. But what usually happened was they got to the colony, and yeah, they were not necessarily required to follow the Church of England, the Anglican Church. But you had to follow their religion. So Rhode Island was actually free, had freedom of religion. It was the first one that had it. Later other colonies did, notably Pennsylvania. That came later. Stephen Mumford is mentioned because he convinced people to keep the Sabbath. But he was not the first pastor of that church. There is this quotation. We enter in a church covenant this 23rd day of December 1671. William Hiscox, pastor. That was the name of the pastor. Stephen Mumford, Samuel Hubbard, Roger Baster, Sister Tacy Hubbard, Sister Mumford, and Sister Rachel Langworthy. That's the church covenant. In 1668, 1680, there are letters between the Milliard Church of London and the Baptist Church of Newport, all Sabbath keepers. Stephen Mumford must have had some money because his house, which is still standing in Newport, Rhode Island, is quite large. The Newport Church still stands too. It now has a facade of brick on it, which was not there when it was first built. It was added sometime later. And the Church of God in Newport does not have the same beliefs as it used to have. They eventually compromised their beliefs with their other religions. 18th and 19th centuries. Well, 1708, collector's record of a Sabbath-keeping church in Westerly, New Jersey. And then, when Count Zinzendorf, the founder of the Moravian Church in Germany, visited America in 1741, he was astonished to find the hold the Sabbatarian doctrine has upon the entire German population of Pennsylvania. That's Corliss F. Randolph's history. This Count Zinzendorf founded this church, and it was a Sabbath-keeping church at the beginning. And he founded it like in 1740. And a year later, he came to America and found that people were keeping the same beliefs. Germans who came from his area came to Pennsylvania, keeping the Sabbath, but of course not anymore. In present West Virginia, I say present West Virginia because it was called Virginia back then. There was no such thing as West Virginia until the Civil War. Virginia, West Virginia separated. March 21, 1853, this is a particular church, it was voted that communion service be held once in 12 months on the 14th day of the first Jewish month, i.e., on the evening of the Passover. It's from Randolph's History of the Seventh-day Baptists. Yes, we do have a church keeping the Passover in 1853. 1859, there was a Wilbur Church of God organized in present West Virginia. They kept the Sabbath and Passover. And I'm mentioning all these notes throughout each century because for almost every century, you can find records of at least one congregation still keeping the Sabbath. Let's go to the 20th century now. 1900, the General Conference of the Church of God incorporated itself in Stanbury, Missouri, and it could only say that it had something less than 1,000 members. Then in 1934, Herbert Armstrong began the Radio Church of God in the Plain Truth magazine. He was part of the Church of God, but he also had this Radio Church of God broadcast and a magazine on the side. He had found that we should be keeping biblical holy days, and he presented that to the Church of God, Seventh Day. From the minutes of the business meeting held in Detroit, Michigan, May 5th to 10th, 1937, by the board of the 12 apostles of the Church of God, Seventh Day, Salem, West Virginia headquarters. May 7th, at 1 p.m., reading of Elder Armstrong's letter to the 12, reading in periods of 20 minutes each of Elder Armstrong's articles on the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the Passover, Pentecost, Feast of Tabernacles, etc., followed each time by discussion pro and con by the elders. A decision was made as given in the following resolution. Inasmuch as some have troubled the churches, teaching them they should observe the Feast of Unleavened Bread and yearly Sabbaths, we reaffirm the teachings of the Church of God on this point, that we observe no such custom. The Church of God, Seventh Day, was rejecting the biblical holy days. It was in 1938 that he, Mr. Armstrong, was asked to turn in his credentials for continuing to preach contrary to church doctrine. This is from John Keats' History of the Church of God. They fired him. He wasn't preaching what they wanted. He was preaching about keeping the holy days, which we keep in the Sabbath Church of God. And they fired him, so he went off on his own. He just continued on his own. And the church that he started continued for many years, circulating 8 million magazines a month, 250 or more TV stations, hundreds of radio stations, reaching millions of people with the message. He died in 1986, sometime after that, as with so many of the other churches that we studied over the centuries, the church abandoned doctrines, and other churches then sprang up. We still kept the true doctrines. Should we be surprised that the truth of the Sabbath continued through the centuries? There's a verse in Hebrews 11, the faith chapter. It talks about people in the past up to that point, because Hebrews was written in the 60s A.D. But let's read it. Hebrews 11, verse 35 through 38. And others were tortured, not accepting deliverance, they might obtain a better resurrection. Still others had a trial of mockings and scourging, yes, and of chains and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn in two, were tempted, were slain with the sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, tormented, of whom the world was not worthy. They wandered in deserts and mountains, in dens and caves of the earth. Sounds like what we just read about people through the centuries wanted to keep the Sabbath and were persecuted in all these ways. Sounds just like that. One of the lessons we have today from what we have seen, how people kept the truth of the Sabbath through the centuries, we learn that they loved the truth. They loved the truth of the Sabbath and the holy days if they knew about them, like Passover, for example, about proper baptism, about the millennium. Some of them understood about that. They loved the truth, willing to die for it if necessary. We see in Matthew 16 a promise, a statement, even I call it a promise by Jesus Christ. He says this, "On this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it." This was a promise that Jesus Christ made. He was going to build the church, and the gates of Hades, Hades means the grave. The gates of the grave means death. Death shall not prevail against the church. He kept that promise. The gates of the grave did not prevail against the church that kept the seventh day Sabbath.